Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Jim Petruzzi, 48 years of combination experience, captain with the City of Pittsburgh Bureau of Fire, who retired back in 2020, stationed at 8 Engine and Truck. One thing about retired members within the fire service is even though they're not on the job anymore, they can still listen, teach, give sound advice, and can relate to so many different situations and experiences because they've been in our shoes. Jim got a little bit of a late start within his career, but was able to absorb and learn from the individuals he wanted to emulate. And when he talks, you can see just how much of an impact they had with his mindset and how he chose to lead. With that, I present Mr. Jim Petruzzi.
Hi, my name is Jim Petruzzi. I started in the fire service in 1972 as a junior firefighter. A lot of my friends at that time in high school also joined as volunteer firefighters. And then I left there and went into the Air Force, where I was also in the fire department. And everything else just led from there.
Okay. Military background. Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
And so I'm assuming upon fulfilling your obligations, how did Pittsburgh come about? How did you find Pittsburgh Fire?
Well, I was on rescue when I was in the Air Force Fire Department for 3 years, and I wanted to do rescue when I got out. And somehow or another, the only place that was doing rescue at that time was Pittsburgh EMS. So when I got out of the military, I went and got my paramedic certification and my degree, and I did 10 years there. Ooh. And then I switched to the fire department. I started with the medics in 79, switched to fire in 89. Okay. And then we were assigned in the fire stations as a medic. So I kind of had a clue about doing that. But then I was more leaning towards rescue then in my younger days. And that was the pathway essentially.
Okay. All right. And so you pretty much were on the EMS side as a paramedic. And then what happened that made you kind of like, not really switch sides, but switch over from EMS to fire?
You know what? It was a lot of the benefit stuff. The retirement package on the fire side, being that the fire department had been here for a few hundred years. EMS was only probably at that time, maybe 20 some years old. So a lot of the pensions different, the healthcare when you retire was different or non-existent on the EMS side. So probably the main thing was the life choice and the benefits. Mm-hmm. And then obviously I think I really wanted to be in the fire service more than anything else. It just took me a while to figure that out.
Okay. So at what age did you step foot into Pittsburgh Fire?
I was 32.
Okay, so a little bit of a late start, but
yeah,
you did 10 years though with EMS. So yeah. Okay, 32. So what was it like coming through Pittsburgh? Was there some sort of academy? How long was it, and things like that?
In fact, I was just at a Christmas party for the fire department here last night, and a lot of the young guys were asking me that same question. You know, how long was my academy? Because their academy now is 8 months. Mine was 14 weeks. And I told them I probably learned more in that 14 weeks than you guys probably learned in the 8 months you were there. I think at that particular time, fire was pretty much still just doing fire. With a little bit of vehicle rescue here or there or hazmat, but still the focus was on, you know, doing the fire service type job. So the academy was it was taxing, mainly because stressful, because I had a job that was paying a decent wage, and I left there and took a pretty decent, pretty big pay cut to go there. Mm-hmm. And then every Friday We would get called into the chief's office, and he would decide whether you were allowed to come back on Monday. Through the they filmed every skill. I think we lost like 12 people out of 36 by the time we graduated. So it was a little different. I think the military background and going through basic training and that kind of stuff helped out a lot with the discipline end of it, and how, you know, your uniform was supposed to be when you got to work and that type of stuff. So, and I, plus I think I, with me being 32, I had a pretty good idea on how things really go.
Some life experience.
And it's, after you get out of there and you kind of get on the job for a while, I think that's when you realize the reasoning behind a lot of that stuff is helps you out as far as doing the job, makes you more disciplined on a lot of different things, kind of enforces that chain of command, that it's, I always use the term the fire service, as far as the officers go, is a dictatorship. It's not a democratic republic. So you can give your advice, but the final decision rests on whoever that officer is. So, and then you just, and that's what you do. So I think the military kind of helps out with that. In the fire service, I think one of the things that's changed is we have a lot more people coming in that do not have the military background. And it takes them a little bit longer to adjust to all that. So probably some advantages and disadvantages. Majority of the guys that I came on with were all military vets. Okay. You know, whatever, through all four branches of service, actually all five branches of service, because there was, I have a couple of friends that were Coast Guard. Okay. So, and sometimes we forget that that's a branch, for some reason. I'm not quite sure why.
Okay. And so you did mention though, like, so, I mean, you're being serious. The fact that when you mentioned, like, the chief would look at the videos of your skills, and if he didn't like it, would just be like, thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah, they were pretty, tough. And there was the old school teaching stuff. It reminded me of, when I played a sport when I was younger, it wasn't unusual for the coach to get right nose to nose and, you know, make sure you were hearing whatever he was saying. The same thing was there. I mean, there was some of the instructors that we had that were, they were yelling, and but you kind of took that as encouragement. I'm sure there may have been some other people that it took it as, you know, they're really getting down on us for no reason. I used that to motivate me and figuring, hey, you know what? And I'd tell them, hey, thanks for letting me really know that in a hard way, because now I know you care, which really upset them sometimes. But that was the way for me to deal with it. Okay. I came out of the academy with the probably the high recruit award for my class, which I still have hanging in my fire room in the basement, along with the picture when a instructor that I highly respected gave that to me. So, I've been very lucky because I've been surrounded by great and excellent people. And they made sure that they passed on a lot of the traditional rules for the fire service. I hope that, I always wanted to be the best firefighter in the world. And then I tell people, I don't know if I ever got there because how do you rate that? But I never stopped trying to be, and doing whatever I had to do that. So, I wouldn't change anything. It was the best career ever, as far as it was kind of heartbreaking when all of a sudden you turn to an age where they tell you you're too old to be here. But it's, I think that happens in everything.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Okay. So upon completion of your rookie school, where were you assigned coming out of the academy?
I went right to 8 engine and truck right out of the academy.
Okay. And For I'm trying to figure out how to word this. All right, so you graduate and then you get assigned to 8 engine 8 truck. Upon walking in there, what was it like knowing like, okay, I've made it through the academy. I'm actually here in this firehouse to work.
You know what? Everyone was pretty accepting. I mean, you are the rookie, so there's certain things that you're expected to do. And I knew that. I think my age had a lot to do with it. Like, hey, when the pump operator or the truck driver pulled the rig out to go through their checks, I didn't wait until or ask them, hey, cannot you show me this piece of equipment? I went out when they were doing their morning checks. And that's where I asked all my questions while they were doing that. And then later on in the day, if I wanted to do an operation on either rig, they were very, it was really easy because all I had to do was ask them. And they said, oh, yeah, sure, I'll take you back out there. The captain that I had was tremendous. He kind of laid out some minor, small expectations. But I build off of those. Like every day, the first thing I did was I checked my SCBA and got my gear ready. And then I went through every compartment on both rigs to make sure all the equipment was there. And I did that all up until the day I retired. So the guys, there was a different ranking structure. You still had a captain and a lieutenant, but the senior guys were. That was like a different, it was kind of like an unknown rank. You knew who the senior guy was because he made the job assignments as far as in the house, clean, you clean this or you do this. And then he went around and he checked it. And if it wasn't up to snuff, then he kind of made sure you were aware of that. And he was the communication between us, especially me as a rookie, and the captain and or the lieutenant. So, excellent, tremendous guy. The whole crew was, it's at the time, I think it was the busiest fire station in Pittsburgh. So they were pretty together on how everything went. Everything was kind of regimented initially there. And then, and you're, and back then you kind of looked at and says, hey, there was no par checks going on then. There was only one rule. You weren't supposed to be by yourself. You had to be with somebody. And your officer needed to know where you were at, where they would leave, say, hey, I need to go out and change cylinders. I already talked to the captain from 7 engine. Go with them. And when I change, I'll be back. So kind of the rules were a little different, I think, but they were all great people. All you had to do is show some incentive that you wanted to be there and that you worked. I mean, the big difference was like the chiefs. You didn't talk. You didn't. We had a chief in our house. Every station I worked in, there was a battalion chief. Me as a firefighter, you didn't sit down and across from the chief and start talking to him. You didn't do that to the captain either. You could do it with the lieutenant because he was more like one of the guys then. So there was a different hierarchy. Now, my last 10 years or so, the chief would sit down there with all of us while he was drinking coffee or having breakfast or whatever. They didn't even eat with us when I first came on. So, I think that could be a good thing or a bad thing, I guess. I was, by the time that started happening, I'd already, reached lieutenant and then, I moved on to captain, and that's as high as I ever wanted to go. So, that chief seat never appealed to me, to be honest, because you're not one of the guys anymore, the way I looked at it, and I like that part. So,
And how long were you a firefighter before you decided to like, hey, I'm gonna take this the next step?
my class kind of got stuck. I come on in '89 and '92. The city they downsized. So we had five squads. We lost all five of those. We lost 11 trucks. And to be honest with you, I can't remember how many engines, but the engines or the trucks in the squads all had lieutenants. So they needed to figure out what they were going to do with those guys. So they called them Red Circle. which means they still got paid as a lieutenant, but they rode in a firefighter seat until they could get that lieutenant spot back. Well, in turn, they didn't give a lieutenant's test for, I think, 9.5 years, or it was 9.5 years before I could, I had 9.5 years before I could take the lieutenant's test.
What was, I'm sorry, I don't want to break your thought. Was that a requirement? Like you couldn't promote for 9 years, or was that just your
No,
rules?
that was because there was all these spare lieutenants.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, and it was, and I think there was, if I remember right, there was like 400 firefighters took that lieutenant's test.
Yeah.
Because they hadn't given one in such a long time. So, so the competition, and I, like I said, I've been there for, you know, 9 years. So I kind of had an idea how smart some of the guys, especially the ones I was working with. And we studied together. Started off as 8 hours every day I was reading. And by the time I was done, when it started getting close, I was doing close to, if I wasn't reading, I was sleeping. And it paid off because I was either number 11 or 12 on that list.
Oh, okay.
And like I said, it was a lot of the guys that I had studied with, they were all right around me. Some of them are ahead of me, some of them right behind me. A couple of them I actually got promoted with. But that worked out because now I had all that experience, where I felt comfortable moving into that seat. Because again, riding in the front's a little different than riding in the back.
Mm-hmm.
I was a lieutenant for 2.5 years. I worked 14 truck, which was in Oakland, part of Pittsburgh, up by Pitt, on Pitt University campus. That unit bounced back and forth between the downtown truck and that truck, between the busiest truck each year. Being right on Pitt's campus was interesting because we were a safe haven for some of the people that were walking around, back and forth to class at night. So it was a nice place. Like I said, 2.5 years I was there. Again, it was a chief's house, and there was no engine at that house. So I missed the double house where we had eight guys, by the time I left eight, there was four on the engine, four on the truck. When I first got there, it was only three on the engine and three on the truck, 'cause we had a tiller. When I left 14 and got promoted, I went to the training academy for 8 months where I sat. I could have got out of there in like 2 months. But I had a friend of mine was a captain at number eight, and he was leaving. So to a retired guy spot in about 5 or 6 months. So I sat and waited until that happened. And then I went right to eight as the captain.
Okay. Where you started.
Yeah. And by then it was the crew that I had was probably the best crew I could start off with as a captain. They didn't mind training. They loved doing what we do. I didn't really have to tell them anything. We just kind of went about our job because they were all seasoned vets at that particular time. So it made things easier. Our lieutenant was a really good friend of mine. He also came from EMS probably about 2 years before I switched. And we had known each other from there. So we talked a lot. We kind of had our game plan. So it was pretty easy working, starting off there. And then probably about after 5 years, those guys all got either promoted or they retired. Then it was like all the guys that I was teaching with on the side that, some people call them the whack bunch, because they would call me and say, "Hey, you got to go on this website and check out this video" type stuff. We all taught classes together here in Allegheny County. Some of us taught at FDIC together. And I had that group for a long time. Two of them, I did their first fire classes when they were 16. And then now I'm working with them. One of them was my lieutenant. The other one's also a lieutenant now, and that whole crew got promoted, and that was when I went to the boat
Okay.
because it
Okay.
was I didn't have enough years left to kind of break in or work with a whole new crew. The fire boat just came back into service after being gone since the early 70s. So I thought, well, that could be a new adventure. And it turned out we boated from like April 5th to December 2nd. And then after that, we became a squad. And I think my last year there, we went to 63 structure fires.
Damn.
So the squad time was probably the main reason I went there. I think I had an intuition that that was going to happen because there was no boathouse that was big enough for that boat. So I knew they were going to have to pull it out of the water. So,
Okay.
and I had an older crew that was on the boat that I could sit down and talk to about some of the TV shows that we watched when we were younger. And then the engine in the truck that we were assigned with, they were all young. So they were a lot of fun to be around. A lot of practical jokes in that with that group.
Sure, I'm
Yeah,
sure.
they built a handicap ramp up to my truck.
Firemen being firemen.
And
Okay.
even painted the right sign on it. So
Okay. One question I have for you, and it seems this is the common denominator. You mentioned your love for training. It's still baffling that we have firefighters to this day that don't want to train. So what's your thoughts on pretty much training in general within the fire service?
Well, I think the main thing was when I looked at the training side and I started, because I taught EMT classes when I was a medic. So I liked the teaching aspect. And when I switched to fire, I had the opportunity to become a state fire instructor here in Pennsylvania. And one of the first things I noticed was the more classes that I was teaching that had to do with whatever rig I was riding on, the better my skills got. And the faster I could work, because it's like anything else. If you want to get really good at something, an old timer told me, teach it first off, because you have to be able to break it down to show someone else how to do it. And the more you do it, the more efficient you get, and the faster you can get. And so I started learning that pretty quick. And then it was just a matter of finding that right group of people, because there's a lot of guys that don't want to train. But if you can find that group that likes that, we would drill. If I was running a little late on setting the drill for the day, those guys would call up and say, "Hey, what are we going out? Are we going out today or what?" And that made me feel really good. So, and it was all things that had to do with. After every fire, we sat down and we talked, and everybody had their input on what they did or what they did. You see anything that we could improve with? And then that's what we set our I, we set the drills up for that. Something as simple as, hey, the one guy, he says, you know what? I don't think our ladders were very quick getting them up today. So we went out and we'd start throwing ladders, and we started noticing that some of the we because we had. One of the things that would happen is I would get a lot of rookies coming out of the training academy because I spent so much time down there, besides the firehouse. So we started noticing that those guys needed more reps on ladders. And as things start getting a little bit old, I start, just from having some connections, here as far as training goes. Mike Champo's New York City lieutenant, who I met at FDIC, and he came into Pittsburgh for I think it was the Pittsburgh Expo, and he did la his ladder class 2 years in a row. Just so happened it was at our training academy in Pittsburgh, and my truck, that training academy is in my district. So I took my crew down, and they went. After the whole thing was over, I haven't seen this technique or that technique with these ladders. And I says, well, that's why we went down there. And so I was never afraid to pick up new or different techniques from anybody. a good friend of mine, he teaches engine stuff and hose advancement, and some of his stuff is amazing on how he sets lines up and how quickly they can get, you know, you can kind of improve getting your hose line in. So one of the questions that you had on there was about being aggressive. Mm-hmm. And so when I looked at that, I broke everything down and said, first off, you got to train until you're proficient, until everything's second nature. You don't have to think about it. I always relate it back to, if you're going to try to hit an 80 mile an hour fastball, you can't be thinking about hitting the 80 mile an hour fastball. You just have to go in there and you have to hit it. And you learn that from reps. So our job in itself is an aggressive job, because that's what you have to do to save lives, but you have to be smart about it. So the more trained and educated you are as far as our job goes, it will allow you to make those decisions, because sometimes you got to make that hard choice, the risk versus benefit choice.
Okay.
So, and it's not an easy one to do. And I tell people, you know, when you got to decide whether you're going to go or not, I said, sometimes I've kind of got up into that window and put my head in and realized, you know what, I'm not getting there in this room. So we got to find another way in. But the training aspect was, you kind of look at things realistically. Where can I make up time? We're on the rig. One of my rules that when I was the captain was, when I get in, the vehicle leaves, whether you're on it or not. So I said, because I'm older, and if I can beat you and I'm coming, my office is the furthest thing away from, or the gym is the furthest thing away from the rig, then you're lollygagging. So, and I'm not going to, oh man, if we could have got here 15 seconds earlier, maybe that person might have come, the outcome would have been better.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of building off of that. So getting on the rig buys you time. You don't have to drive 90 mile an hour. You can drive the speed limit. But when you get off, you got to be ready to work. And you got all your stuff on. I used to tell some of the younger officers, I have 15 seconds to make my mind up on what we're going to do. Because if I take longer, you're going to decide to do what you want to do. And I can't have that part. So, I learned to do size up from my probably first three captains I still am amazed at some of the stuff that they come up with. Like my first captain, it seemed like no matter what was going on, we always had a good shot at the fire. He kind of knew coming off where it was. So everything is, because the job to me is aggressive, but you got to be smart about it. You have
right.
to be,
right.
It's our responsibility to make sure that we do everything that we can where we go home. And when you become an officer, it's not only my responsibility to make sure I go home, it's my responsibility to make sure everyone else goes home from at least my crews. So it's kind of hard to take responsibility for some another unit on how they're going to be, but it spread as far as the training goes. I'd have single engines calling me, hey, are you going to drill today? What are you going to do? Which was kind of impressive that they would call the truck that, hey, I haven't been on the truck for a while. Can, you know, we come down and go over the rapid intervention gear or whatever. So, to me, the whole fire service comes down to responsibility. You need to be responsible for you. And if you decide to be an officer, responsible for your crew. And you need to make sure that they're able to do what we do. Because right. it's a dangerous job. Probably one of the examples that I usually give is, I've been pulled out of, you know, a number of buildings, and just like anybody else, you know, it's the chief's decision. So when I come out and we do whatever that fire needs, I've been grabbed by those same chiefs and it's, hey, can you go in and check to see what's going on inside the building? Because they know that I'm going to not going to take too any unnecessary chances. And I had been around long enough to know, hey, this building's not stable. We can't put anybody in there, or this, we can maybe do this from the ladder or whatever. So, and I had a lot of pride in that. And I did make the promise to my family that I would do everything in my power to make sure I come home every day. Mm-hmm. Which means you have to train, you have to educate, you have to have an open mind, because sometimes the youngest guy on the job can teach you something. And a lot of, there's no room for arrogance. There's too many people in the fire service that know a lot of stuff or came from other places that do things just a little bit different. But then, yeah, every once in a while I had to remind them, hey, you know what, this is a dictatorship. So this is what we're going to do.
I gotcha. But I love the fact that you mentioned and you hit on that, because, you know, there are some individuals out there when they get promoted to the rank of lieutenant captain, you know, they think, hey, like, nobody else's input matters. But to get that crew camaraderie, to get that respect that you talked about, like, you listen sometimes to your junior member that might have a really good idea.
And I tell people, that badge, that lieutenant or captain's badge doesn't come with the background that you know what the hell you're doing. Mm-hmm. You have to make sure that you're ready for that. And I have, I've gotten a lot of calls from a number of younger guys that, because I think we can get promoted to lieutenant. You can take the lieutenant's test right out of the academy, but you can't get promoted until you have at least 2 years, I think. And each rank is a minimum of 2 years. But they'll call and say, hey, you know what, I got 5 years on, but I don't think I'm ready. And I just let them know, dude, I've had a number of fires with you. You're more ready than you think. Remember, there's part of a on-the-job training for those ranks. You're not just going to jump in the front seat and have all the knowledge that you need to run that. So you need to read a lot of books and take a look, you know, brush up and figure out what you're weak in. I could tell you that there's two things that almost every firefighter that I know at one time in their career, they're weak in: SCBA and ladders. The one says, well, how do you get SCBA? I said, I do a lot of training. I said, At one time I was wearing the SCBA about 100 hours a month between all the different classes that I was teaching and working in the firehouse. I said, was I breathing air on all those calls I was at work? No, but I had it on and I practiced with that thing. And you know, the example that I use is when I had a MSA when I first got on. When the bell stopped ringing, I had like a breath and a half left. And everybody, well, how did you know that? I says, well, I kept wearing it and breathing it down. I says, because you need to at least have that face piece sucked to your face one time.
Mm-hmm.
I said, when we switched to Dregger, when that whistle stopped, you had no, there's no breath. And I've done a couple little polls, like, hey, what's your low air alarm run off of? And it's amazing that a lot of firefighters don't know that it's running off the air that's in your cylinder. So while you're low on air, it's essentially wasting air for setting off your whistle or your bell. So I just had a class with, and this guy's only probably been in the fire service maybe 10 years. And he says to me, well, why don't you shut your cylinder off in between breaths? He says, that way you're not wasting any air. So I have not timed it. His thought to me was, you could probably gain about 30 seconds or a little bit more breathing time. So I can't do anything but believe you. I said, I don't know how I could test that out. Because you got to think, sitting in a chair is going to be totally different than if you're, you know, trapped on the second floor and right. You can't figure out where, you know, the way out.
Right.
So, And that's the other thing that I've come across as far as training is everybody wants to do this survival class and they take it one time. And then they think that that's going to save them if they get stuck on the upper floors. And they got these fancy rope systems now. And I said, have you trained with it? Well, no. I says, well, so we're going to find you next to the window trying to figure out how to use this system, and you're not going to be with us any longer because you didn't train with it. And things have changed. Like when I first started doing teaching survival or taking it, no one ever mentioned closing the door.
Okay.
And that's the first thing we have doors set up in all of our in where all of our drills are. So the first thing is close the door and Mayday. Who, what, where? That was the other thing. No one ever practiced doing Maydays. When they first came out, they wanted us to do this lunar thing. I'm thinking, okay, you got a panicked firefighter that's lost or trapped, and you're going to expect him to know. Why don't you have dispatch? They can answer. They can ask them those questions if you need all that info. Otherwise, it's like who, what, where will tell you, hey, they're having an issue. In closing the door, we kind of figured out we did a couple unofficial tests. Like that Lawan door took about 2.5 minutes to burn through, the hollow core door. I have a couple friends that I know that were in fires that they actually closed the door and they pretty much saved their crews. They still got some burns, but they were all alive. And if he didn't close that door, they didn't get in that room. I don't think they'd be with us any longer. So it's always a continuous learning. Like right now, I was thinking about taking a couple classes, and I'm like, you know what? I think you're done. I teach survival still one class, and I teach a search class that I put together that I think really emphasizes search because I don't think we focus enough on search. I know our basic essentials class here in PA, they do search one day and they're holding on to each other's boot, they're holding each other's hand,
Right,
and they're
right.
moving like turtles. And then when they get into our search class, they're like flabbergasted because didn't never realize that they got 4 to 6 minutes or a lot less for you to get them. And otherwise, you might get them out, but they're not going to be very viable. So, and you still have to follow rules. Or, how many firefighters know that if you're searching above the fire and the engine starts hitting the fire, and you're using your tick, the steam comes upstairs, the camera's going to white out. I don't know. I throw that question out, and no, I have not got the right answer. So it's. And in reality, it's common sense because I talked to a couple of the camera people. I said, I thought you guys told us these weren't going to white out any longer because that's what they did when they first came out. And the first question that they asked me is, was there steam? And I'm like, yeah, well, steam's all around you. So it's going to be all the same temperature. And then we got guys that are out there that are teaching it's not that bad above the fire. That tells me that you haven't been there. If you tell me it's not a bad place to, it's not that bad up there. Everything's coming to you. The fire's coming to you. All the heat's coming to you. The steam's coming to you.
Right.
You're above the fire. I just tell everybody, if someone tells you it's not that bad above the fire, they've never been there because it's horrible. And it's something that I've enjoyed teaching that class, and I've had a lot of feedback where guys call, they'll text me or they'll send me an email. Hey, thank you for I used everything that I learned in your class. We got rescued this person, or we rescued that person.
Right.
But those are my two main focuses. Rescue is very dangerous, probably one of the most dangerous because you have no hose line, and the survival allows you that if you do have an issue to prepare for it. It's like, hey, have you ever been trapped above the fire? And I'm like, well, yes. Have you ever went in before the engine got there and searched? And yes. If I didn't go in, we wouldn't have got the two little girls. We wouldn't have had time to hear them crying. But we were smart. I closed the fire room door. I had my aerial operator put the aerial with the light on to the third floor window. And when we went to go back downstairs, we had gotten the girls out, went back in for another gentleman, and fire was coming up the steps. And we went to the third floor, and there was the aerial went right down the ladder. So in reality, we weren't trapped.
Right.
It was a prep thing. I knew the area was going to be there. And probably just as that happened, the engine got there. So we went to the third floor, at least in my opinion, at the right time, because obviously there's no way they can put fire out that's going up the steps by, they use straight streams, obviously, but it's still going to have some push. But we weren't even singed. And that's a lot of it, prep. How, you should be able to get out a lot faster than you went in. And you got to prep to make sure you have one way in, two ways out at least. So yeah, I did 32 years and I come out pretty whole.
Okay.
There's old person issues, but I don't have too many things that I had injured at the in the fire department. I mean, I had my injuries just like everybody else, but they're, most of that stuff is long gone.
Right. Okay. And in your 32 years, what, in your opinion, what have you seen the fire service improve on? And what are some of the things you're just like, I can't believe, like, whatever is still going on today?
I'm not, I, well, I know that, we need, I don't think we train enough, especially with the new construction stuff. Like I was just talking to a couple of young guys last night and they were talking about the roofs. And I said, well, to be honest with you, I think once the new construction takes over, where it's everywhere, roof vent is probably going to be by the wayside. Because the trusses or the roofs are, they're not going to be strong enough unless you can cut it from the aerial. We probably need some improvement with our search. Everybody, a lot of people that I talk to, they don't even go in and search unless someone's been reported in there. I've had my fires where there was supposed to be nobody in there. We found people. I also had times where you go in because there's multiple, they're saying there's people in there and you go in and they went out the back door. So no one really knows for sure. So I personally always searched any building that we can get into that was where I felt that there was somebody viable. And even we did parts of buildings that were viable, but the rest of the building wasn't. So our search technique could be better. Our RIT training is adequate, but most of the guys, they don't want to train with RIT. I've had some really good chiefs that actually had, they just, hey, can you take the tr go around with the truck and hit and go over the RIT equipment with the single engines and some of the other, how to operate that stuff. So, and I just put that out as, hey, you know what? You could be the guy that's in there. Do you want someone who knows what they're doing, or do you want someone who hasn't trained? I says your viability as far as life goes downhill if they're not trained really very well. I think the biggest thing with the fire service is it does change. A lot of the old timers used to tell me, no, the fire service never changes, but it does change. I think it changes because the people change. The each generation doesn't think that the next one is any good. That's been going on forever.
Right.
I went through these last two generations, the millennials, and I think this new one is what, Gen Z.
Yes.
The advantage for me is I have two children that are millennials, so I had kind of had a pretty good idea how they are. They're no different than anybody else. They have different priorities as far as this tech stuff. I almost had to call one of them to figure out how to do this call. And this new generation, I have grandkids that are in this in that generation. And one of the classes that I'm doing is Allegheny County Fire Academy started this program with high school kids that start attracting younger kids to be junior or firefighters. And there's like 32 kids in this class, and they're from like 5 to 7 different high schools. They come to the academy 2 days a month for 4 hours each day, and they get the state's basic fire class through high school. Some of them come in, when they come in as freshmen, they don't belong to a fire department, but then they meet the other kids. Next thing you know, they come back in, they joined the fire department. And that group, which is probably between 14 and 17 or 18, they're some of the hardest working people I've ever been around. They never want to stop. Can I do it one more time? And same thing with, the millennials are now older. They're probably, I think, up to maybe almost 40. Okay. And it's unbelievable. I've had them where there's like 10 minutes of class left. Do you think we can do one more rope bail? And I don't have a problem staying late. It's just sometimes the places that we're teaching at, there's someone else there that's overseeing us. And
gotcha.
So I always check with them. Hey, do you mind if they do one more? Because sometimes they don't have anything else to do after work. So I've changed. I've always liked working with the juniors. And I keep telling people, because I have friends that do not like teaching the juniors. And I said, well, their attitude is your problem. You can adjust that. If you keep them busy and you make it fun, you won't have any problems with them. And I said, number one key is keep them busy, because think about it. When you were a teenager, if you weren't busy, you got into mischief.
Right.
So, in training, if you keep it fun, people are going to want to do it more. So, even when I was the time I spent in our training academy, which when you're teaching the professional paid fire department guys, who it is their job right there. And then you got the volunteers coming in who are giving up their time. I always treated both of them the same as far as the training goes and how I did the class. Hey, these people are here on their own time. They don't need someone yapping at them and being mean to them and being rude. They need to have fun. And the guys that are getting paid, and they want to do this as a job, I just let them know it's going to be hard. But I had some drills that, like hose advancement drills, where I'd make a little contest between groups, and one group got to wet the other group. But they got a lot better at putting the hose out, getting the hose off and getting it laid out right. Getting it through like a maze of cones without knocking the cones over. So, and I didn't treat them any different. You know, some people, when you're in recruit school, you get treated like you're like the bottom of the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't treat them that way. My thing was, the day you're sitting in that chair in the academy is the day I consider you being one of us. And my job is to make sure that you know what you're doing when you leave here, because I certainly don't want you not knowing what you're doing and killing me at a fire because you didn't know what you were doing. So my incentive later on was, because I start getting close to the end, and I'm thinking, you know, it's my son's here in Pittsburgh, and he's a captain in Oakland right now, and he's getting ready to hit 19 or 20 years. So my last couple of years, I tell him, I don't want you doing anything dumb and killing my own kid.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think I always felt like I got through. I did like 22 classes I worked with. I was only at the academy for two of them, I think. The rest of them, I was coming back and forth from the firehouse. And the chief, my last class, told me, he says, hey, I just want to let you know, I'm pretty sure you have trained 80% of the fire bureau, which made me feel pretty good. So
right.
It's always nice to have your hand in and to kind of help people through. For our job, the EMT class is the hardest thing for those guys to get through while they're in the academy. If you go to the college, they do it over 3 months plus. They do it in our academy in 5 weeks.
Mm.
And it's tough.
A
So,
lot of information. Yeah.
and I've gotten, I mean, if someone's struggling, hey, you know what? I'm working on this day. If you want, come to number eight and I'll go over, I can go over stuff with you because I was in that seat. So, my wife was a paramedic of 32 years with the city of Pittsburgh. So there was a couple people. I just, hey, you know what? My wife's pretty really good at that part. Why don't you, if you come by, I'll talk to her, come by the house and she can go over that with you. So, and some people don't really, they just can't, don't get that you don't have to get paid for everything. Some things you have to do because you're passing on or you're kind of paying it forward. It's similar to do like that high school class. I don't get paid to do that. I said that's 8 hours a month. I think I can deal with 8 hours. I coached baseball. Now I'm coaching softball, girls softball. That's 3 days a week. There's always a give back. The fire service has been tremendous for me. I mean, I couldn't think of working any other job. And the only thing I have to be careful of is sometimes when you're talking to the high school kids, they want to know what path you went. And I don't really like telling anybody else's kids, well, the military, and because they start thinking, that's a choice between them and their parents.
Absolutely.
So I leave that part out most of the time, but I did start as a volunteer when I was 16 years old. There was no child labor law then. So it was a little different than what it is now, but, and then I got with the medics, and that's when I realized that I'd rather be a fireman. So, and the cool thing is somebody always asks about different classes, and I said, well, first off, the cert that they give you at the end doesn't mean anything to me. It's what I learned out of that class, and the advantage is I've been teaching for a long time, so I know what instructors are better teachers than others. I said, but I have over 200 certificates I keep in a binder that I don't remember the last time I looked in there.
Okay.
So it's probably the biggest thing that means something to me is when I made the overall outstanding recruit in the training academy because I missed having the fitness thing by two push-ups. And I missed the grades by 0.5, but then I got overall. So probably the most stressful thing was when there was a Pennsylvania had a thing then. It was called first responder. It was like almost first aid thing. While I was being a medic, I had to take that while I was in the training academy and get that cert. My biggest fear was failing that because I'm thinking I was a paramedic. I can't be failing the most basic, first aid thing.
Right.
Must have read that book about 50 times. But it's I'm probably my worst enemy as far as stress goes.
I think we all
But
are. Yeah.
I've never been afraid to make mistakes. So when I'm taking classes, and I take classes not only with the city firefighters, I take them with everybody that's around us that goes to our county fire academy or some of the surrounding counties. And some of the thing is, oh man, you work for the city. Why are you here? Well, I want to know this. Or I wouldn't have, I'd have thought you'd have known how to do that. And I'm like, well, that's why I'm here. I said, I don't know how to do everything.
Right.
That and to be honest with you, I'm not real happy about how I performed here because I think my skills should be better. And something is wearing Lev Way and have to pick up a dime with those heavy gloves on. I mean, I'm thinking I should be able to do this. I figured it out that I could use another dime, but it took me a while. So,
Okay.
and I that's why. So I've never been afraid to put myself out there. The IAFF has a survival class that was 5 days long to do the instructor class. I took that class when I was 60. It was the hardest class I've ever taken in my entire life. The first station, you wore your mask. They took your SCBA and they put it down a hallway. and they set the pass device off, and they went through these steps that you were going to have to perform. And but at no time did they ever tell you that you were going to have to find your way back out. So I did count doors. So it was 200 feet in, 200 feet out. I did make the right choice, but I was the only one that got out of there, I think. And it was luck. I flipped a coin. I thought for sure I had to go right, but I chose left. I had brush burns on my knees the size of softballs. And I still had 4.5 days to go. So most challenging class, all the instructors were from all over the country. They were all IAFF instructors. And they were some of the best people I'd ever met as far as making sure that the class was fun and making sure that you felt comfortable and everything was positive. Something as simple as at the end of this one drill, the instructor says, okay, I'm going to shut your air off and I want you to go through your drill as if you were running out of air. So she had preempted us at the beginning where, because in Pennsylvania, they teach pull your regulator out, get low, pull your regulator out, pull your hood up over the hole.
Okay.
She came up with, she said, hey, take your thumbs, put them on your face piece, and just slide your chin out. And then I realized that my hood was still there. And she said, the advantage is if someone comes in with the RIT pack and connects to you to give you air, you just have to pull your face piece, your chin back in your face piece. What I got out of it, though, too, was I could keep my face a lot closer to the ground as I was crawling with that technique. So that's the one I used after that. But it was probably the best one. I rate that as the best class I'd ever taken. You know, every person that was there they were like super firemen. Okay. They demoed every drill, which told you they're not just able to talk about the drills; they're able to do the drills. Getting tangled up in wires, and they made it. My only complaint to a couple of them was, you made it look too easy.
Right.
Which tells me your skills are really good, because I knew it wasn't easy, especially when I got in there and I'm thinking, he cleared this so easily. After about the fourth time through with their instruction prior to that and their incentive of, you know, that giving you that little bit of a push, whizzed right through that. So, and that to me is the real good instructors, because we have some, I don't know if we have any really any bad ones, but we have some that could probably use a little bit of work on that end.
Right.
That stand there and read slides. I usually tell them I know how to read. So,
yeah, death by PowerPoint.
Yeah. I pretty much just show pictures now and then I can rattle off everything that I want to cover on that picture. But, okay. It's been one heck of a ride, though. That's I had the opportunity to meet guys that I had only read their books, like John
mm-hmm.
Norman.
Mm-hmm.
I had read pretty much everything that he has out, had written, and then I got to meet him. I co-wrote Residential Search Book. I wrote three chapters. So I was doing a book signing, and he was right beside me. What a gentleman. We conversed about the fire service. He actually stayed a little longer and he waited for my son to get there, because he came out there with me on my last year. And then he spent an hour and a half talking to him about the fire service, which was super nice. Paul Combs, mm-hmm. The cartoonist. Mm-hmm. Actually, I've talked with him a couple times. Super, super person. It's amazing who, you know, you get to meet those guys and you think this guy's a rock star. Rick Lasky, I mean, super, another super guy. I've read his book about 20 times. Just goes on and on. And I'm thinking I had the opportunity to rub elbows and sit down and have a meal with these guys. And it was amazing. So, writing a book that when I was in college, I taught a young lady how to play racquetball, and she did all my papers. So I was lucky I could even write my name. And here I have to write three chapters.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so it was an event, but I had some good proofreaders. And I have a poster that MSA did. It's hanging in my basement. I just wanted like an 8x10. It's a full size poster. I think it's cool as crap that it's been everywhere. I've had to sign some of them for people who I've run into at some of the expos. I have a lot of pictures with them. And that was, I mean, how often do you really, in a lifetime, do you get an opportunity to do a real photo shoot where there's wardrobe and makeup and, multiple photographers and the uncomfortable thing about wearing the SCBA as tight as they could get it on you, so all the logos would show. And
Right. I do have a quick question though. What would your advice be for when it comes to leadership as far as anybody that's aspiring to be a company officer?
remember where you came from. Treat people fair. And probably the biggest thing that I got from my preemptive captains were believe in them. If they can believe that you'll do anything for them to help them, because everybody goes through life and everybody has issues. And sometimes it's nice to know that if you're struggling with an issue, someone's going to be can help you and not make it worse. So, at number eight, I was responsible for seven other people it's when we were in the station. So, and those seven people come, they can help. Everybody has their own issues. I mean, that's part of life. And, whether they're going through some serious issues that can be life-changing for them, you can give them a lot of help. There's some of the underlying issues that you might notice that they might not come to you, like some people turn to alcohol, some people turn to drugs. I always had a firm rule. First off, everybody that I know, there's something wrong with them. I'm going to accept your issues and you're going to accept my issues. Just personality style types. And I always told them, I don't, there's two things I will can't tolerate or put up with, because I'll have to send you home, is don't come here after you've been drinking and you're intoxicated, and don't be on drugs, because now you can affect the rest of us. And I never had an issue. Now what they do on their personal time is up to them, but just don't come to work with that. But treating people fairly, and I've had some issues. And just doing that special thing. Like I had a young firefighter that we picked for vacation, and he had three young kids, and he didn't have enough time to get Christmas. So I had vacation on Christmas. So I said, "Hey, I'll come in and work for you during the day. I just need you to be in here by 3:30, because my family will be at my house at 4 o'clock." So he was able to spend his Christmas morning with his kids, because we had switched to 24s. My kids were all grown. So my last probably 8 or 9 years, I worked for people on Christmas Eve and Christmas morning. This mainly the one mainly the guys that had kids. There was no payback. So, because when I was younger and my kids were all little, I never had to work Christmas. Somebody always stepped up. One of the older guys took that. So, and I never had to pay them back for that. So, and I said, that's the stuff we do. That's, so those special things. And I don't typically pick vacation on Christmas. But I picked vacation there because I knew I could get it. And actually I put in for it and got it. And the reason I did was so that I could work for him. and he could be off. I've had a couple guys over the years that had medical issues, and I always went to the hospital. And some of them, I can honestly say that I probably, especially off the job, we were pretty close friends. That's a friendship thing too. But there was some that we worked together, and that was pretty much as far as it went. And but I still, if they had, if I still went to the hospital and made sure they were okay. And I think it, the good officer, to me, good officers do that. They're, my responsibility was them, and to make sure they came home, and if, to make sure that if they had anything that I could help them with it, I if I was able to do that, I did that. And I never belittled anybody. I mean, I had one guy that everybody always picked at us, picked at me about him being there, and he was older. And finally, he came to me and he said, "Hey, is there, do you have a problem with how?" I said, "No, I don't have a problem with you. If I'd had a problem with you, we'd have been already had this chat." I said, "The problem is not with me, it's with them. So we don't have a problem, and you don't have a problem with them, and I don't have a problem with them. That's just them yapping their lips." So, he told me, he says, "Well, I'm going to stay." He says, "But 2 weeks after you leave, I'm going to bid." And darn if he didn't do that. I went to the fireboat, and he bid the next bid period, which
Okay.
was I just actually seen him last night, and
Okay.
yeah, it's there's always, first off, I never wanted to push someone that was an issue onto somebody else. So I always figured out, how to deal with it. And that's where it came down to. We have, there's eight personalities on that one line. And we were all willing to accept the, I guess, the weak personalities from each other because we all had them. Like there's no perfect person. There's just I just looked at it sometimes as we're just a bunch of misfits, and as long as we can accept our misfit, then we're good. So that's kind of the way I went with on things. My lieutenant was I had numerous ones. Every one of them pretty much was easy to deal with. Well, except for one. He was a little, he was like a problem child, but he worked his way out of it. And your people look up to you. And that's one of the things that I think we need to realize, that we're in the eyes of a lot of younger people, especially if you teach, like this high school class that I teach, and being around some of the junior firefighters when I teach classes, or the brand new firefighters coming out of the academy, because people learn from what you do more than what you say. So, probably the best example of that is when I was on, I ended up on the captains ended up on the truck. The captains initially were on the engine. So I had 6 years on eight engine, and then I switched over to the truck. When I was on the engine, I did not go over and check anything on the truck. That was the lieutenant's job. So when I was on the truck, I didn't really worry too much about the engine. Well, what I started noticing was none of the truck guys, the guys that were on the truck, would go out and go through any of the compartments until I went through them. So I asked them the one day, I says, "Hey, why aren't you guys going through the compartments?" They says, "We do go through the compartments, but after you go through, because when you go through, you put everything back to where it's supposed to be." And that was the way that they learned on where everything went. So after about probably 6 or 8 months of everybody doing that, when we'd switch rigs, I really didn't have to worry about them putting everything back to where it went because they learned where everything's supposed to go. So it's, and they knew certain things. There was at 9 o'clock, we did housework because at 9 o'clock, I started doing housework. I always checked my SCBA the first thing in the morning, even before I got coffee. And those guys would come out, and sometimes every once in a while they'd bring their coffee with them, but they would grab it and go right out and check their SCBA and get their gear on the rig. So, like I said, it's like that unwritten word that, hey, you know what? I need to do this because that's what he's doing.
Right. Lean
And
by example.
yeah, and sometimes it's not easy. And sometimes you have to kind of have a one of those realistic chats with each other. And I was never one to, hey, I need to see you up in the office and rattle you with a bunch of stuff that maybe some expectations that you weren't doing. I more or less come up, hey, you know what? Let's have a conversation. And that way I get input because there may be a reason that maybe you're not doing certain things the way that I would really like to see them done. And that always worked because it's like a two-way street. You know, like I said, people have issues and sometimes, you know, that can affect work
Yeah.
or how they're doing stuff. So, and there's so many, I mean, I've been starting to write down some of the funny stories because there's so much crazy stuff that happens, like somebody taking a 12-foot pike pole to the second floor or third floor up the stairwell and listening to all that and then trying to watch them try to pull the ceiling.
Right.
Or showing a young firefighter, and it works like 1 out of 10 times, if that, where you knock out the window with the 12-foot pike pole from the outside and pull the middle sash, and you make a big circle. And when you pull the pike pole out, the drapes and the blinds come with it. And I'm like, it works. So I don't tell him that. I just showed him it. So he tries it. Just as he's doing it, five other guys are coming around the side of the building, and it works for him. He pulls all this stuff out. Well, they're over there patting him on the back, telling him how wonderful he is, and he just winks at me because I had told him, you know, I don't know, it works 1 out of 10 times.
Right.
Yeah, it's an adventure. It's probably the sense of accomplishment when you finish the job and everybody gets to go home. You explain to the younger ones that fires just don't work like clockwork. If everything's going perfect, that's when I start to get scared, because something's got to go wrong. And know how to break that chain, because every fire death, if you know from reading them, there's always that chain that goes along that if you take one little thing away, it doesn't happen.
Right.
So trying to learn and to get them to learn what's the links in that chain and how can I break it? You know, so yeah, it's one heck of a ride.
Awesome. That's awesome.
I will be honest though, I don't miss it. I miss the firehouse a little bit, but you know, I realized that I actually had a 3-alarm fire the night before my last day. And we were sent in for search, you know, and the chief was a little hesitant because my last day was tomorrow. So we had no visibility when we got up there. So we're crawling, and I was working with a guy that I'd worked with for years and years. So we split. He was doing the left side, I was doing the right side. We're just yelling back and forth. And smoke started to clear when I got into the hallway, and I'm thinking, uh-oh, I'm gonna need to stand up here shortly. And before these young guys see that I'm going to need their help to get up off this floor. But I did. I got up, and with a little bit of ribbing later, old man, you really held up. And that told me, hey, I had my turn. And I'm good with it. I feel pretty good about what I was able to accomplish while I was here. And I'm probably living vicariously through my son now because he's carrying on a lot of the stuff and beliefs that I had with the training. He has props built in their basement of their fire station for doing bailouts and forcing doors and just regular truck stuff. So yeah, it's in the friendships. I mean, I'm still pretty tight with. I have friends all over the country that, you know, I met at FDIC or I taught with at FDIC, and some of them are coming back into Pittsburgh in August to do this one class. It's a memorial class. So that where we were last year, where back where I met you. I've known Steve for a long time, Steve Robertson. He probably, I don't even know how many years he taught with us out at FDIC, but we had guys from Charlotte and Providence and Clearwater, Florida. I mean, there's guys from all over. So we would sit around after class, and it was like you were getting a free class for nothing with different things people were doing across the country. So, which I brought everything back. I brought everything I got there, I brought back to Pittsburgh. Probably the mo one of the best things was we called it a backstretch, where you lay the hose down and stretch it right in front of the door, straight away from the door, and everything's laid out right in front of the door. Instead of running back and forth in front of the house, I kept thinking, wow, I bet that looked really funny on video. So, it's probably got inbraided in me when I was a junior, because there was a lot of so-called whackers that were in that fire department, that they probably lived and breathed fire and made it fun for me. And when I went in the military, I had that same type of people there. Ended up on rescue, which is the best place to be. And so everywhere I've been, I've had great mentors that kind of showed me the way and how you're supposed to be. And then occasionally you get that one that's not so good, which really kind of emphasizes the good ones. I think everybody should have the opportunity to work with one of them, just so they know how good the other ones really were. And I great people and great firefighters. And sometimes that gets under emphasized. I think, I can't remember the exact number. I want to say it's like, since I started with the city, maybe 12 firefighter deaths. Probably some of them were my friends. So those were tough times, and I still think of them a lot. The Valentine's Day fire, that's my oldest daughter's birthday, so that's like it's Valentine's Day. It was Briceland Street in Pittsburgh. We lost three firefighters and my daughter's birthday. So it's like a constant reminder of that particular fire. And didn't really know the captain real well, but both firefighters, they were from eight. They were detailed to 17. One was engaged to one of my mentors and friends, and the other one was the son of a deputy chief who used to swing by the station all the time. So there was some, it was con some connections with that whole thing, which made it. And you know what? That probably hit my in my career, where I started in '89, so that was '95, where you start to think that maybe you're a little invincible. And then that was the wake-up call for me. That really made that I was always learning, but that really made the push to make sure I knew how to size up. And as you know, what you see on the outside typically isn't what you find on the inside. I mean, I've had fires where we take the inch and three quarter in because that's what it looked like from the outside. And next thing you know, dude, we need the 2.5. So you know how to you learn how to make the correct read, and then you learn how to adjust. And I don't know how many times I've gotten to the top of the steps and there'd be a young firefighter there and he's hitting fire and it's not getting smaller. And that, hey, what are you doing? I'm trying to put this fire out, Cap. Well, you know what, it's getting bigger. Oh, and then after the fire, it's, you know what, you know why I brought the other line? I got another line in there. You didn't have enough water. If the fire doesn't get smaller when you're putting water on it, you need more water, and you need to back up. So, kind of use it as a learning thing, and or something that we do here in Pennsylvania We have a barn building out at North Park, and for years we'd take students in there. And you'd take them into the room that's on fire. It started off because they wanted, the instructors wanted you to feel the heat. Well, then they'd have you put the fire out while you're in there. And then I started noticing that some of the young guys, they're getting burnt at these fires. And I'm like, well, what are you doing? And they're explaining to me that they're going into the room. And I'm like, we need to change our training. You don't go in that room. Angle in the doorway, hit ceiling to the left, shift over, hit ceiling to the right, sweep back and forth, move up, hit what you can, blast the window out, vent, and then you go in. I said, you'll never get burnt. So, does that work every time? No, but it's better than going in the room and opening the nozzle and getting steam burned.
Absolutely.
The job's changed some, I think, for the better. And I think there's some stuff that we probably still need to change, that probably needed changed years ago. Something as simple as if you follow SCBA, we weren't sealing our face piece. I used MSA when I first started, and we would go through and check your seal and all that stuff, and we would have leaks. Well, then they came out with positive pressure, the SCBA companies, because we didn't know how to check our face pieces, and we still had leaks, but we could hear them now. And they failed to tell us that if you're working hard, you can overbreathe the positive pressure. Guys didn't check their gauges. They were running out of air in the building, so now we have Christmas lights in our face piece. So just little things that sometimes, I don't know, maybe we need to take a look at ourselves and figure out, at one time SCBAs were 800, now they're like 10,000 with all the electronics. I've never needed that Christmas light in my face piece because I check my gauge before I go in. If I'm changing levels, I check my gauge. If I'm doing changing jobs, I check my gauge. Because I know the last thing that you want to do in there is run out of air, because no matter how good the RIT team is, there's a chance they're not going to get to you on time. So it's so we're kind of in our like ladders. We don't throw ladders because they're too heavy. But then when you watch someone throwing a ladder that's even an experienced person, they look like a monkey in a football. There it's like I don't even know how you got that ladder up, and you had to move it like five times. I don't really like to throw ladders because they're too heavy. I'm like, well, there's a lot of stuff that I don't like to do, but I still have to do it because that's what we do. Hose line advancement, just getting a hose around the corner. Some nozzle guys think that their job is to just hold on to the nozzle and yell back to you and cuss at you to pull hose, when in reality, they could go back to the top of the steps and grab the hose and then crawl back up the hallway while you're pushing it up the steps. So, I mean, things have adjusted, I think. I still think that we need to educate a lot better, just so we know that we can move faster. We could be more aggressive because we're more knowledgeable and we can read things a lot better. Because we have to move fast and get in there to get them out as quickly as possible. In fact, I had one of the senior captains that I have the utmost respect for. We were having a discussion on covering exposures, and he said, "I know this isn't what the book says, but I, in my experience, I find that going inside and putting the fire out takes care of the exposure too."
Definitely.
I'm thinking, yeah, that's
Sure.
very true.
Yeah.
So,
Yep.
but again, I mean, those guys, he can make that read on what he can get or what he was able, but some people aren't at that level yet. There was a captain at number eight that was doing positive pressure ventilation, and I always tell people, because they say, "Hey, do you know anything about positive pressure?" I says, "I know enough to burn the building down, because that's how much knowledge I got from my friend and mentor before he retired." I said, and I at that point I'm thinking, you know what, I still need to figure this out. And then I every time I see him, I says, "You know what? You kind of failed me. You didn't teach me everything I need to know about positive pressure." And he just laughs. So
Oh, but Cap, I appreciate the knowledge, and that's why I also like talking to individuals that have so many years of service under their belt. Even though they have successfully retired, they've been able to get to the end of that line where it's like retirement's here. I appreciate talking to people like you that have the knowledge, the gems, the little nuggets that are being spilled out, and you could tell us how it was back in the day. So I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Oh, no problem, bud. I enjoyed it.
And if I want to ask a question, I always like to ask the guests, where they would like to see themselves before they retire. And you retired as a captain, and you mentioned earlier that's as far as you wanted to go. So it's probably safe to assume you have no regrets, right?
Oh, no. There was to me, there was always a line. Once you made captain, you were still one of the guys. When you made chief, you can no longer be one of the guys because you have to do stuff that typically may not be advantageous to the guys. So, running the fire from the outside. Those guys, they're not the chief's not supposed to be your friend. He's your boss. So he runs fires, and that's who I look to because I learned early on, I can't see everything when I'm inside. I can only see my little space. So when he pulls, blows the horns and pulls us out, I've never run over there. Why are you pulling us out? I know when I get out there that there was something that he's seen to make him do that. And I did make a mistake early on when I was a captain on the pumper. I got on the radio and said, "Hey," called the chief. And I said, "Hey, we got this." And it was blown out the third floor above us. So now after that, I'd say, "Hey, we got everything knocked down on this floor. Are you seeing anything else?"
Gotcha.
I kept thinking, man, I felt really dumb after that. Hey, yeah, it's blown out the third floor window.
Right,
So,
right.
yeah, it's so I was real. I never took the battalion chief's test. I signed up a couple times, but I never talked myself into taking it. So
Okay.
I was right where I wanted to be. To me, the captain is the best job in the fire department. Has the least headaches as far as I was concerned. And I got to work with some really great people. And that's my biggest thing was some people say, "Well, do you judge people?" No, I don't judge people. Except for good people and bad people. There's bad people that I really don't kind of stay away from, and then there's a crap load of good people
Okay.
that come from all over. And it was so nice meeting that group of people that I got to work with. In fact, I've seen a lot of them last night. I still have mentors that are still with us that luckily they were only a few years older than me. Like my lieutenant he's a year younger than me when I first came on, and my captain was only a year older. So I had those guys for a long time. They taught me. In fact, my lieutenant was probably the best truck guy I ever met. Cutting the roof, figuring out where the hole goes, or going in for search or whatever we were doing. He was right on. Like I said, my captain, he always put us in the right spot. So, and I learned so much from them because after every fire that we called it the meeting of the square table, and we would go through the whole fire. And initially, my first fire, I got bombarded with questions. "Hey, what did you see? Why did we take this hose? What was going on over here?" And I'm like, "I don't have a clue." And then I'm thinking, this is the last time I'm gonna look stupid at this table. So, and it made me start paying attention, which means I had to learn. So, to the point where he went from telling me what hose to bring to, "Hey, grab the hose and meet me on the porch." And to make me make the read.
Right.
And the first time I made the wrong read, fire was on that first floor when we went in, and I had five sections of hose I had to get rid of, which I ran around the dining room table to get rid of. And when the chief came up, he said, "Hey, who laid this hose real nice around the dining room table?" And I grabbed the wrong hose, chief. He says, "Yeah, obviously." So, and that was when I learned the ultimate thing. Firefighters, we learn by making mistakes. And the only dumb fireman is the one that keeps making the same ones.
That's right. That's right. I love it. Love the message, Chief. Thank you. Or I'm sorry. Love the message, Cap. Chief out of that title. I really appreciate you doing this and spending some time out of your day to talk shop about the fire service.
No problem. Hey, are you coming up in August?
Sean asked me, he actually texted me the new flyer for Jimmy Ellis, and I told him it all depends on what's going on calendar wise and with the family. So I'll let you know though.
All right. Hope to see you there.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you.
All right, bud. Thank you.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.